Hello and welcome to the Afroverse with me, Hope Hajir. Our guest today is Lois Ogola, who's a comedian from South Africa, whose Netflix stand-up original is the first ever to be filmed in Africa. Thank you so much for being here, Lois. So welcome to the Afroverse.
Yeah, thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. I am cool, man. I'm fine. I'm about to go on tour in London.
Did you move to London?
Yeah.
Permanently, Loiso?
I'm here. I mean, I'm here for the foreseeable future, but I've moved.
Oh, wow. But you're like a nomad because you're like Mr. Easy. Those people who, you know, you can move to anywhere, just do your thing, like out of a suitcase and just your personality. You just go as you are and you're fine wherever.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a big adapter. When I was young, we used to move a lot with my folks. So I'm kind of used to it now. It's like I can just pack up and move to another place. So I don't, this time next year, I don't think I'll be living in London. I'll be living in another city. I don't know what city it's going to be yet.
Why London specifically?
There's comedy here. Tons of it. You can perform as many times. That's how you get better.
I like that you moved there specifically for that, especially for comedy. It's a muscle you have to keep flexing and all that. But in terms of these venues, what would you say is like the best location you've ever played at? Like in terms of country, right?
I mean, there's a club in London called Top Secret Comedy Club. I think it's one of the best spaces to do stand-up. But I go to other places and I gain something different from there. The Top Secret Comedy Club is the place I play the most. Yeah, so I mean, so the hyperbole, oh my God, I don't know. I mean, there was a great room that I played in Copenhagen, which was amazing.
Copenhagen. Yeah. I would love to go there. I saw your video on, you know, when you were performing at the Top Secret Club and you were essentially dealing with a heckler. Man, you handed it to her. You dealt with her so far. I will actually put it right here. You guys just listen to what happened.
Why don't white people clean their shoes? Clean your fucking shoes. I bought these in 1979. Did you say why?
Yeah, with what?
Did you say with what? No, listen. I would have said some shit that would have made the whole room go, what the fuck are you talking about? Everybody would have sat back. Don't tempt me, bitch. Why do I clean wet wipes? I'm just saying, like, this is not, we're not flying a fucking man to the moon. We're cleaning sneakers here. It's just a concern that I had. Anyway, whatever, do your shit. I'm joking, it's a joke. Bro, are you telling me you've worn white sneakers all this time and this is the first time you thought of cleaning your fucking sneakers? I'm in this now. I don't give a fuck. I'm here. I came here to tell you some jokes. Karen is talking. But I will take all your questions.
Really liked it. And how often would you say you encounter hecklers? Like on average, what would you say is like the statistic? Like 10%, let's say, of your audience has to have like shouting shit.
Nah, maybe like 1 in 10. It's rare, but I play so much that it becomes frequent. Like, so maybe like 1 a week, but it's very rare. It's something that I'm ready for. And it's something that always happens.
Speaking of like something that always happens, you spoke about in one of your specials, in actually like a 30-minute thing you did for comedians around the world, you were basically the African, and that was the title. I loved it. That's actually how I discovered you. And you spoke about how, or let's say Americans, I don't know if it was Canadians, make things out of things that are not things. And so speaking of, I wanted to know what's like the thing you think you've made a thing out of that is not even really a thing.
Oh, I don't know. What do I make a thing that's a thing? Yeah, I mean, football is not a real thing. It's a thing, but it's not a real thing. I don't know. I think, you know, when I put out those ideas onto the special, I think that was my thought process on those things. I haven't thought about it any further. I mean, there's a lot of things. I'm trying to think, what things do I... I'll oh, my God, I don't know.
Like, for me, it's the color burgundy. I even freaking have it tattooed on my arm. And my twin is always just like, just paint a fucking wall. Don't tattoo a color on your arm in black and it's burgundy. So my thing is colors. I love colors and I feel like they represent emotions. When I was a kid, I used to say, I feel red, I feel yellow, I feel green today. And people never used to understand, but it's my thing. That's a thing. That's not really a thing. What do you think that is for you?
Probably buying sneakers. That's not a real thing, but it's a thing. Wow. I mean, I consume sneakers, but it's not a real thing. It's not a reflection on my confidence. And it's crazy because I don't have, like, if I have 50 sneakers,
yeah,
maybe three of them would be like limited.
Right.
I'm probably not going to buy like highly limited sneakers. I'll just buy like sneakers that I like. And then I think I can wear with the clothes that I have at the time. So it's, and I know sneakers are a thing now, but they're not really a thing. Like,
right.
It's a thing that's not really a thing. And I'm like, I feel corny sometimes even being involved in that world. I'm like, oh, this is so stupid.
I literally got my first ever pair of sneakers, but now I get it. First of all, you can wear them a lot and it's like art. It's like a personality thing. It tells you a lot
about
personality, you know, like the colors, the texture.
That's connected to like my parents' parents were not allowed to own land or grow economically. It was against the law. So for them, and you know, like in a modern society, you know, if someone has a house in a very affluent neighborhood or whatever, that's the symbol of a come up in that sense. So if you're not allowed to do that, where do you derive a sense of dignity? You derive it from clothes and how you look, because you know you're not allowed to acquire assets.
Right.
So you have to look. You have to look the part, uh-huh. Right? And so black people just had to look sharp because it's salvaging some dignity. You know what I mean?
Most, yeah. Of what you.
Yeah. So that kind of gets passed on because my mom would never allow me out without if my t-shirt was ironed.
Right.
I don't know how many times my mom was like, stop. Like, I think I was like 9 or 10. She'd make me take off the shirt and she'd iron it. And I'm like, I'm going to miss the train or whatever. She's like, you can't, just, you know, whereas with my white friends, they just get to step. And it's, yeah. And so I try to explain that to someone because they're like, yeah, it's just shoes. It doesn't make sense. And you're like, nah, it's, for us, it's attached to a certain level of dignity.
And you grew up with your brother, and he's also a comedian. And I've, like, for both of you to be comedians for this long, what is it that you feel made both of you comedians? Do you think it's just totally genetics? Or is there something about your upbringing that made it that both of you are also comedians?
I've never really thought of it. I think it's very common now in the NBA where you have, because if you, in this, yeah, the similar experience kind of stuff, and then, I don't know. I can't really articulate. I've never really thought of it, if I'm being honest. Never really sat down and be like, why is this the case? Maybe I should investigate that. That would be an interesting thing to investigate.
I think so too. You guys are very different in your style though. Have you guys ever worked together?
Yeah. I mean, we've done many things together. We did a commercial together for Dorito. But my brother's a director. He's more of a director. He does stand up, but he's more of a director. He directs adverts.
Oh, nice. So he's a director type.
Yeah. He's more well-versed in like, he does way more than me. I just do stand-up and he does stand-up and he directs, he writes commercials, he's in writing rooms. My brother does a lot, yeah. He does way more than me.
Right. Did he ever like write for the late night news? I think I saw that you actually...
Yeah.
A satirical show, reading the news and all that. That was cool.
Yeah, he wrote for like maybe like for a year, and then... It was him and his friends. And they were comics as well. And then I fired them at some point because they were just...
You fired your brother.
I fired all of them at the same time. It wasn't like no, I was...
It was in the same pool.
Yeah, because they were just... They were like at the point of their lives where they were just having... We were taking the thing way more seriously than they were.
Yeah.
And they weren't... I mean, they were great. And, I, you know, like it was crazy because sometimes the thing has run its course. We didn't fight about it. We were just like, yeah, I don't think you guys want to be here.
Right, so you had to just make the decision. I'm sure that wasn't easy because you have to.
No, it was very
prioritize.
Easy.
He moved on, easy. Though. He really moved on.
No, it wasn't even like a bad thing. It was like, yeah, I don't think you guys must come do this thing. Go do other things. It wasn't like, you know.
How did you end up doing that show? Because it's very different from stand up, and you did it for quite a long time.
I just pitched it. Like, as my career was taking off in South Africa, what started happening, people started offering me shows I didn't want to do. And then what I knew about doing stuff is that even if the money is good, you still have to do it. It's still your time and energy. So why don't I create something I want to do with my time and energy? And so I just always wanted to do a satirical show. I remember wanting to do it because I used to see Bill Maher. And he was on the Oprah show. And me and my mom used to watch the Oprah show a lot because mm-hmm. She'd come from work and then the Oprah show would be on or just, you know.
Right.
I remember once seeing Bill Maher and he had the show and this is probably 1999 or something. And I'd always wanted to do a show like that, a show where I'd always been interested in that show where you sit on a desk and you talk about the happenings of the news, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, cool, let me pitch that kind of show. And someone was interested in it. And then we did it. We did it for like 6 years.
What?
Yeah, well, we used to take breaks. I mean, it was once a week. Then we'd take maybe 2 month break and then we'll come back. Then we'd take, you know what I mean? But it was great, man. It was really great. I had a really great time. We had really great TV bosses. I had a great team of people. Yeah, I've kind of always worked with the same team of people. Like, we used to have this other sketch show back in the day called the Pure Manati Show. Right. So it was a South African show. It was huge. Like, it was probably, yeah, it was probably the biggest show I'd ever done. Like, it was huge. And the show got canceled for whatever reason. But so the same group of people were doing my show,
mm-hmm.
oh. like the late night news show. And then same group of people shot the special. So we're always constantly working together. It's just easier that way. It's like, it's weird working with a different group of people. It's great, but it's always like, we're just on two different planets about what's funny and what's interesting. And I mean, I'm turning 40 in 2 years and I'm like, maybe I should like learn to work with a different group of people, but
basically maintained.
Yeah, man. I work. Yeah.
And I saw that you worked with, I think David Kibuka, if I'm not mispronouncing his name.
Yeah, yeah.
He's now, I think, on The Daily Show, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very interesting how things actually aligned for him.
Yeah, he was writing on the first show as well, the Pure Manati Show. And then he wrote on the Late Night News Show. But it was so crazy. The day they announced that Trevor's hosting the Daily Show was the day, it was our last episode. It was crazy because what would happen, it was actually literally the last episode. And then the weird thing is that I was flying to New York the same day. I mean, not the same day, the next day. And Dave was on the show and he had been writing on the show. And so he was like, he was going to the Daily Show. And so he's been on the Daily Show, but he did the show with us for 6 years. Highly serendipitous set of events.
Honestly, but I love that. It was very like the perfect alignment for him. And I, to confess, the first time I ever saw him was on Come Dine With Me. So it was very interesting to actually see that he's the same guy because I couldn't believe it. Because on Come Dine With Me, he was literally roasted for cooking something called chapati. And they didn't know what to do with his Ugandan, you know, self. He was saying he was a comedian and no one could believe him. And it's very interesting to see that he actually had a whole trajectory going on. I saw him on The Daily Show after seeing him on Come Dine With Me, and I didn't know what to do, you know? I'm happy to know things worked out for him. I'm really happy.
No, I still have not seen this episode. It's quite an infamous episode. Yeah, no, he always tells me. Like, I remember him telling me that he's gonna approach to do this thing, and I was like, that's crazy. Because his house, I don't know if in the episode they showed the view.
I don't know if I remember.
Because his house was on the hill. Like in not on the hill, but it's like on the top of Joburg. So if you at his house, one of the you could see the whole city.
Ooh, okay.
It was a great. So I was like, yeah, no, whatever you do, I remember telling whatever you do, just make sure the view, you know, sell the view. But I still haven't seen the episode. I don't. I actually need to actually go try find the episode.
Honestly, you need, and you know the saddest thing I feel for him now, knowing the quality of his work, is people kept saying, "You're saying you're a comedian, but you're not making us laugh." And the thing I've realized is, it must be really annoying, like being a comedian sometimes, because people give you that look for, you go on, punchline. Do you ever go through that when in random conversations, especially with dating? Do you ever like feel pressure from women, just like make me laugh?
No.
I feel like it's because you're chill, though.
Maybe. I don't know.
Trust me, you need to watch it. You need to watch it. He went through actually too much. Come to think of it, he went through too much. But how was the experience doing unlearning? Currently, is there anything you're actively unlearning? I know you've probably been asked that before, but let's just, for current Afroverse listeners.
No, I just think I the only thing I'm learning, I'm learning to trust myself more. That's it. Which is, I don't know. It's like you try to not allow too much doubt into your ideas and your planning. So I think for me, what I need to learn is to trust myself way more and be like, no, it's going to be fine. You've done this before. You can do this. You know, that's my biggest thing now. It's like just leaping and going, trust yourself.
There's this paradox by Mark Manson. I'm sure you know him, for Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And he talks about this paradox for like the more you want something, the harder it feels to attain it. Because you just start dwelling on it and you just start overthinking it. And then like as you do it, you just really get obsessed over the details and you're not really listening to yourself as well. Because your instincts are not going to survive in those environments. They're just going to be up against the wall, you know?
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's actually true. Because you're making decisions constantly. And then when you scrutinize decisions, you start overthinking things. And then when you're like, when I initially made the decision, there was a certain instinct and intuition involved. Let's just go with that. And that's it. I think that's the simple end of that stick. It's like, yo, let's, okay, cool. This is, and also there's no right or wrong. It's the decision you made with the information you had at the time.
That's true.
So you gotta, you know, here's the information I have now. Boom, let's go, you know.
And if you fuck up, you fuck up. You just move. You won't die. You'll say, okay, unless you do die. But like, you just go going. As we say, Kenyans, we just say, go going.
Yes. Even if you die, you don't die.
Well, amen. Unless you're Buddhist, then no, it's awkward. But yeah, but you don't die. And that's the moral of it. I noticed you have a sleeve tattoo. Like, and it's a very odd sleeve tattoo because it's genuinely, like, it looks like a sleeve. Like, it's genuinely just a black all the way down from your shoulder to your elbow, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no real reason. Like, I did a lot of crazy things in my 20s. I mean, I just got inked up and I wanted it to go like as far as here and it was painful. And I was like, I don't want to do that again. But I think at some point I got to like get the tattoo all the way to my, on my, you know, hand.
But I just feel like it's painful because it's a blanket. Like it's an entire, like, there's no designs, nothing. It's just complete shading across the arm.
Yeah, it was painful. Do I regret it? Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. No, I don't. No, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to finish it, but it was so intense when I did it that I don't want to.
Well, good luck with the shading. Okay. Because you don't want to look like you have two shades of black, you know, just walking around like some nice palette, you know. It's going to be interesting. I wish you all the best, though. I do wish you all the best, Luisa.
Thank you. I mean, I'll be fine. This is, in my list of things to sort out, this is probably not up there. Yeah, it's not like something I'm like, ugh. That's why I haven't done it, because I don't think about it as much. It's not in my brain
right. That much.
I just keep moving.
As you do know, this is a podcast with primarily like an African diaspora and audience. And I'm very curious to know, like, what's your stance on, or what's your opinion of the current like comedy scene? I feel like the Kenyan one is just starting. I don't know if you've ever tried doing stand-up in Kenya, but it literally started very oddly in a pandemic when no one could meet, that's suddenly when people were able to attend comedy shows in Nairobi. That's mostly like stand-up comedy, not, you know, very performative humor, so to speak. I feel like South Africa really knows what it's doing in terms of stand-up. But in terms of like Africa and the diaspora, what's the general feel you've been getting of late in working with other comics?
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Nigeria. I did a gig in Mombasa, but it was a New Year's Eve gig.
Oh, nice.
It was not like, but it was, this is like 2019. I don't know. I just got on stage. There were bands and stuff. I was just one of the acts. I was like, okay, I guess, whatever. And it was cool. I mean, I had a good time. I was there for like a week.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 2019. Yeah. I've been to like Namibia, Zambia. I mean, for festivals or something, stuff like that, but not intensively, no. Or not like with intention of like touring. So I haven't really played. Remember, like, Africans are not one thing, you know? So when you go to a place, you're like, culturally, I have no idea what's going on here. You know what I mean? And you probably have more in common to a British person than like a rural Tanzanian person. Then when you try to tell them stuff, they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so like, then you're like, then when you start like doing stand-up, you're like, they're like, what are you talking about? And then you go, okay, me and this people are not people in that way. We're not
one.
There's no signal. Yeah, we're not one. And so then you go, I'm gonna go to where people make things for the world.
Right.
That's usually the US and Britain, where they, you know, one of the biggest exports is popular culture.
Right.
Because you kind of like get the DNA of what people understand, and you work around that frame, and then you insert your beliefs and ideas into those. But I think at the end of the day, what I'm trying to say is it's hard. It's hard playing. Like if you play to a Congolese person, they're like Francophones, man. They don't know these. You know what I mean? They don't,
yeah.
They speak French. They speak English in the second language.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Some other countries, people speak English, but they speak it in a very practical way. They speak their own language. And then it's like, you see here, I wasted, not wasted my time, but it's like, well, this is not going to work. I think I did a gig in Lusaka when I was still starting out, and I really enjoyed that. But I really struggled with connecting with people.
Yeah.
In South Africa, I do fine. I do fine in South Africa, even Lagos. But then it's also weird when you think of like the diaspora outside of Africa. Like, so you go, okay, now I'm in London. And then Africans come to your show. But then the thing is, when Africans come to your show in London, these people, let's say they've been living in London 12 years, they just want to them, you remind me of parts of home. And then, so then they want you to talk about home. Then I go, no.
They're not from the same home.
Yeah, but they also just want to, you know, I mean, if you're 12% of the population, you yearn for blackness, or 4% of the population, you want blackness all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you gravitate towards it. Then I'm talking about pumpkins, and then they go, no, man, tell us about being black. Then you're like, and then you're like, can I tell you about pumpkins and puppies? They're like, no,
garlic.
You can't. Uh-huh. We'll get that. You see what I'm saying? So it's to navigate all those things is quite crazy, man. But you find your pocket of existence.
And your current, like, your next special is called Pop Culture. So I think...
Well, that's what I'm touring now.
I'm manifesting. I don't know if it's in the books already, but it's going to be a special. Me, I'm ready.
Okay, thank you. I accept all manifestations and cash.
Okay. I'm working on one. So I think before we even get to Pop Culture, I want to know a bit about like you growing up. I feel like, you know, doing anything in the arts, especially from a background like ours, a very survival based background, something in economic thought is that before self-expression comes survival in all economies. And a lot of African economies are still in survival mode. And that's why the companies that are flourishing are utility companies or politicians or things that aid in survival or service delivery. And lack thereof, this goes without mentioning.
Yes.
Or at least in the case of Kenya. But how was it kind of branching into comedy? Because you started really early, like, you know, the Chappellian type of age of early. But it's actually quite a luxury. And I'm sure there were some influences, like, really, like, nudging you forward. Or was it just total conviction? Like, were you a total rebel, like, going for it and just saying, you know what, I'm standing on this hill of comedy and I'm dying of laughter on this hill?
Remember, if you don't have, like, a university fund waiting, then the person can't, you know what I mean? Like, if a person doesn't have, if there isn't like money to take it to university off the on a whim, right? Like,
right.
So then you can't stand in the way of options.
Right.
That's an unreasonable position, I think. It's like, okay, cool, we're done. But I mean, let's explore options. But the thing is, I started when I was 17. So that was in high school. So by the time I finish high school, I'm fully in it. It's part of my day to day. You know, I'm doing shows, I'm doing this, you know, and it just became easy for me to get into it. I mean, I don't think that I wasn't also a troublesome kid in that sense. You know, I wasn't like getting into trouble. Mm-hmm. So it was easy for my mom to trust me with the decision.
And I think it's very interesting because you've kind of stuck to the core tool of your profession, which is stand up, like you with the audience. And I love that because you connect with the audience. I don't know about you, but for me, if I don't feel like I connect to the audience, like with TV, you don't feel the reward immediately, you know. With you guys, it's just live on stage and it's very electric. And I envy you guys, like comedians, musicians, and all people who can perform on stage. But I'm sure last year really like put anything. Do you feel like last year changed your comedy career in any way? Like fundamentally?
I don't know. I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I was just at home chilling, which was great because I'd been on the road for so long. I was like, man, let me just chill. And I, you know, also because it was like a time of uncertainty. So you were just like worried about, I wasn't worried about jokes at all. I didn't care for jokes. I was like, yeah, people are 2 million people dying. Just died. Like, right. Why do I care about a punchline? I mean, you know what I mean? This doesn't make sense to me. Like, so for me, it was
a time to chill. You're just taking
chill, man. I just chilled. I was in Joburg, and then I had this apartment renovated, but I hadn't lived in it.
Mm.
So lockdown gave me an opportunity to kind of live in it. Like I hadn't spent more than like maybe 2 weeks in there. And right. So when I was locked out, I was like, okay, cool. Now I'm in this house that I spent so much time making comfortable. But now I'm like, I'm in the house. But the only thing is I didn't have all the furniture I needed. So I had some furniture, but I didn't have the furniture that I wanted and need, you know. But I ended up getting the furniture and it was great. My stay was great. Like being at home was fantastic.
Do you find like performing back home after this situation when you're in London and all that, do you feel like you kind of have to re-switch? Do you find yourself kind of like code switching with audiences a lot? Or do you feel like you've found that sweet spot where you're just going with whatever humans here is what you're saying, regardless of culture or audience?
Yeah, I try to impose my ideas on the people. I don't want their idea of life to, you know, affect how I perform to them. I just go, okay, cool. I'm here. I know you guys are the Christian society of whatever,
mm-hmm.
but I'm going to tell you this pro homosexuality material, and whether you like it or not, I can't go, oh, they don't like that, therefore I don't care. It, you know, so I don't try to pander to anybody. I just go, yeah, whatever, man. Like, it's, I try, like, I go, this bit about race is going to make these people feel uncomfortable. But fuck it, whatever, let's go.
They'll be fine.
They're not going to die. No one's life is in danger.
Tell me about pop culture and the current tour you're on. What's basically the thinking behind it?
I think sometimes we take for granted the influence pop culture has on our lives and how we live. And I think, so the show kind of brings those kind of themes forward, like, you know, pop culture, these people who are seemingly knuckleheads are really powerful, and they're very cognizant of what they're up to and they're doing, you know, and they're very calculated. That's not what I really say, but I hope by the end of the show, there's like a part of that that's like, oh my God, okay, yeah, of course. Like, I mean, how does Donald Trump become the head of state? It's because he's been subconsciously placing himself in your brain for like 30 years on TV. And so when he's on TV, it's not crazy. You're used to him. And so you're like, oh, how did we? Oh, it's because this guy is just there. And it's not. So when he says crazy stuff, it's not crazy anymore. Right. It's just like, oh, yeah, yeah, that's that guy. But then, you know, now you have someone who spent their last 30 years creating policy. And then I'm like, yeah, but the average human being doesn't understand how policy is drafted, doesn't understand economics, doesn't understand the financial system. Right. And you're going to come, hey, we're cutting this. And then Donald Trump is like, look at this goofball. And then people go, yeah, what we understand is goofball. And then so it's like, and that's all pop culture is absolutely responsible for that. I'm not writing a thesis, so I'm not going to put it like that, but
the jokes people are along those lines.
Yeah, they, you know, they open you up to like, you know, can you see what's happening here? You know? Mm. And so I even tell people like, so do you understand why people ban American media in their countries? They go, yo, we can't expose our people to these things. Because it's not crazy. It's not like because you go, no, it's freedoms. You're like, nah, bro. This guy is literally saying, no Kanye West in my country. The country will be fine without Kanye West, trust me.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's not like, it's one way of manipulating a society without them even knowing, you know? So, you know, those are the things that I really want to dive into while I get into them. If I can get into them properly, then I can get into them.
It's a certain charm, which is studied and it's delivered very deliberately. It could be seen as manipulative, or it could just be seen as showmanship, you know, like it's just you doing whatever the business requires of you and you knowing how to work a crowd, so to speak. So like, where do you stand on that? Because it's pop culture. Some people like it, some people don't. What's your opinion of pop culture? Like your own personal one?
It'll always exist. It's always existed as... I'm in the realm of popular culture, so there's nothing fundamentally wrong with it. But I just think people need to understand it for what it is, as opposed to people feel lost. You know, that's why they find religion has been over. You know, religion has been hijacked by some really manipulative people. And so people are very reluctant to kind of turn to religion. So they turn away from religion. But the thing, the value of religion is that these society, the idea of cultivating society took maybe a couple of thousands of years, maybe like, you know, so by the time you get Christianity now or in whatever form, for it to even exist sort of in this ribbon, once you go, we are not subscribing to that. I say Christianity, but I mean like any religion. Once we get a society that goes, we are not subscribing to that, we've got our own ideas, then you go, yeah, but what you're missing here is that you don't have 4,000 years to cultivate an idea that's... So that's the value of it. I mean, I'm not a religious person at all, mm-hmm. but I have to understand that this thing is formed of a... thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years and evolved and right. Yeah, yeah, and it's been manipulated or whatever. So now once people extract themselves from those things, which is very new, they lost in a weird way. They're like, what then happens, they turn to people who they connect with on their screens. Kevin Samuels, I don't know if you like those kind of, you know, like those kind of people now get to be a part of, like, you know, wow, popular culture, and people kind of gravitate towards those kind of humans, and that's a very like dangerous situation.
So it's like pop culture could be like a form of religion in the sense that
it is a form of religion. I don't even discuss pop culture to this length in the show. It's just, I'm just, you know, these are things I've thought about. Like if I was writing a thesis on pop culture, these are the things I'd talk about.
As far as objectivity goes, I think you really try to, like a professional devil's advocate, you know? Because you really try to weigh in things. And it takes a lot of like suppressing your ego and knowing you don't know everything. But at the same time, you find that balance between catering to your own experience, your own emotions, But at the same time, considering that we don't know fucking jack shit, so therefore it's important to, you know, take in some other accounts. And I like that. I like that. And even if you don't go that deep into the show that explicitly, I think it's cool. I think it's cool that even, like, you're saying it on here, because now my experience going in to look like watch the show or hopefully somehow find myself in London, from my mouth to God's ears, please, universe, hi. But yeah, like if I could watch any of your, you know, any of your routines, that would be nice. And I think knowing that, and with anyone listening to this, knowing that, it just, it slaps harder, as pop culture says, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hope you get to watch it soon. I mean, I don't know. I hope I'll take it to the world soon.
Yeah. How was getting your show onto like Netflix? How was getting that deal? You know, there's this, you know, Stormzy, the UK rapper. And doing Grime, he always talks about how he really brought Grime out to the world. Like, he wasn't the first person to do Grime, but he's really the one who popularized it to the world. But he feels like he wouldn't be able to fully reap the rewards of the path that he's set. Like Ricky Gervais, for example, if I have not butchered his name. For him, he essentially created mockumentaries, you know, like with The Office. And now Parks and Rec has been developed from that. So many other shows have been developed from that. And he's literally, you could say that his rewards have been so much less than what people are getting from that style of comedy now. And same with Stormzy, like his rewards, like looking at what people will get from Grime in the future are just less. And I feel like you are like on a new path, such that people who now come up with, you know, stand-up specials, like stand-up originals with Netflix in the future, who are African or maybe any, like any of these other groups, let me say the others, any of us others, I think it's very interesting to see how you've pioneered that, but you've just started like something that should have been there from a while back, from when Netflix started, you know? And in doing that, how was that experience for you? Like, was it as difficult or was it just easy? Because you've spent a lot of time in the industry. So maybe you just had the connections. Things just worked out Kibuka style.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was cool. It was just that there was a pandemic, because we started talking before the pandemic, maybe like a month before it happened. Maybe it's like two weeks before it's. And then, so during the pandemic, we were trying to tie together strings and try to figure out how we were going to pull it off. Yeah, I was just happy we pulled it off. You know, I was really just like, oh, shit, okay, we did this. This is insane. But I was just afraid that I hadn't performed enough leading up to it. And so I just had to figure out how to work the material again, because the material was old. It's stuff that I've been maybe touring for the last 4 years prior to that. And so then it was just like, okay, cool, let's tape this and give it to the world. But it was just an anxious time, not because there was a special involved, because there's a pandemic and then there's health issues. If one person on set is sick, then we all, you know, there's curfews, there's lockdowns, there's this, there's all kinds of stuff that that was the main inside. But I just had a good team of people around me. It was, you know, Netflix was extremely accommodating to any situation we were facing. So it was great, man. It was really fire.
Thank you so much, Luiso, for that very, very, I think it was a short, and usually I have very long episodes on here. But thank you so
really?
Much. Really? Yeah. Yeah, I usually go in because I like to really flesh out things. I don't just like to have like question, answer. I don't know how to mentally. Okay. I don't know how human beings talk like that. Yeah, but thank you so much for being on here. I really appreciate it. I wish you all the best as you
thank
go
you.
On to, you know, tour with pop culture. And we are currently manifesting the specials, yes? So you're receiving
yes.
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am receiving my attendance in those specials, and as you film it, even as you tour, I'd love to watch you perform live. But for now, I will settle on a podcast episode with you. Thank you so much, my listener, for being on here. If you're doing laundry, if you're washing dishes, whatever you're up to, man, I just hope you have a lovely day. And as always, thank you so much for listening on the Afrobus, and I will catch you on here next time. Bye.